listening to Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. It is a beautiful summer day, so let's hit the water. We're headed to Marina del Rey for a sailboat race, one of the longest-running regattas in the entire region. It's called the Sundown Series. Now, this is an amateur race. It's also known as a beer can race, if that tells you anything about how seriously people take it. It's open to anyone, and it only costs $5 to enter. It takes place every third Friday of the month from May to September, and we're racing, so let's get on board.
Right now, we're sitting on board the vessel Rascal, and Rascal is a 37.5-foot sailboat, and I have my crew on board along with my co-skipper and owner. My name is Kathy St. Amant. I held a 100-ton Coast Guard captain's license. I've been sailing since 1972. Yeah, I'm getting old. And when we get out here on the water on Friday nights, it's a relaxing, supposedly. The design of this race, we literally have a lot of physical activity for the first part of the race, and it really can burn out some people. But year after year, everybody keeps coming back for more.
And KCRW's David Weinberg takes us on board the Rascal and out to sea.
The crew members of Rascal change from race to race, but they always begin with a tradition.
I need sustenance.
Before the race, they pour a round of shots, rum or whiskey, your choice.
All right, you guys, you ready?
One, two, three, Rascals! Woo!
The shot glasses are gathered up and taken down into the cabin as everyone gets into position for the race. There are 8 people on the crew for tonight's race. All but 1 are women. They have a range of sailing experience. The more regulars of the bunch are sporting teal shirts with the Rascal logo, a cartoon Loch Ness monster with a pirate's hat. At the helm tonight is Monica Chabon, a professor at Santa Monica College.
You're a whiskey guy?
I am.
Yeah,
I
me too.
She and her partner, Kathy St. Amant, are the owners of Rascal. The Sundown Series is put on by the Del Rey Yacht Club, one of the oldest in Marina Del Rey. It was founded in 1952 by 5 friends after they were rejected from joining any of the existing Southern California yacht clubs because they were Jewish. Today, it's open to anyone. And the Sundown Regatta is also open to anyone, not just members of the Del Rey Yacht Club. The race is a short one, 1.5 miles, out past the breakwater and back. Tonight, about 12 boats are racing straight out into the open Pacific, rounding a buoy, competing to be the first to cross a waving flag. Once we are in position, we make our way to the starting flag, and a small horn announces the start of the race.
Okay. So the start line is between those 2 orange flags.
Okay.
Right? You can be late, but don't be early. If you're over early, you gotta go around and do it again. Okay. And in a short race, that's it, you're toast.
At the bow of the boat, manning the sails is Stacy Sinclair. The first part of the race was low key, letting the wind push us gently through the channel. Docked sailboats and luxury yachts glide by as the boats stake out their positions, trying to make the most of the breeze and block competing boats in the process.
Okay, so Dutchess, they're coming up to try to cover us. They want to get a little bit of a lift off this opening between the buildings, right? And they're trying to cut us off and give us their bad air. They also don't want to fall down and be in squall's bad air. Okay, so as the air is coming across the sails, behind it, you've got turbulence. And if you get caught in the turbulence, you're going slower than you could have gone if you were in clear air.
Once we get outside the breakwater, it gets intense. The swell pushes the boat up and down. There's a lot of tacking, which means changing the direction of the boat to shift the way the wind pushes against the sails. That also means the crew has to constantly jump back and forth from one side of the boat to the other. It's actually more like crawling. Feet first, you have to stay low so the sails don't bonk you or knock you overboard. We round the buoy and head back towards the breakwater.
Okay, we're in racing sequence.
Yeah,
get that lazy sheet off. The lazy sheet's stuck on somebody. Look ahead.
Once we get inside the marina, things calm down. This part of the race is pretty calm. There's time to kick back a little, talk about sailing and work. Kathy, the co-skipper of Rascal, was also a professor at Santa Monica College, but has retired. These days, she spends a lot of her time on her boat, and when she's not sailing, she does advocacy and nonprofit work to get more women into sailing.
And a lot of us here coach what's called Seagals, which is another nonprofit for women that we go down and coach the women. So we're all big on helping other women get into boating. When I started this, I was always the only female on the boat. The guys were always gracious and sweet, but women weren't welcome. I was just lucky. I ended up in the newspaper because I was a female on board a boat in that race. That was in 1973. Now women are big in the sport. And we kick ass too, don't we?
One of the organizations Kathy is involved with is WOW, Women on the Water, a nonprofit whose goal is to promote and empower women sailors.
Most of the guys that own boats don't give up the helm very often, and the only way to learn is to get on the helm. So with these special nights, the Women on the Water nights, the men will actually hand over the helm to a woman, and then she gets to drive the whole race and get some experience in it. And it's really the only time that it ever happens, until you buy your own boat. If you don't own your boat, very few get the chance to take the helm.
Kathy says this race in particular has been very open to women.
This particular regatta, when it first started, was really the first opportunity for women to get out on boats. The guys are so generous in handing their boats over, too.
As we make our way towards the finish line, we're able to pass another boat ahead of us. But because this race is open to boats of different ratings and classifications, it's not necessarily the boat that crosses the finish line first that wins. There's a point system that gives handicaps to even the playing field. In the end, we came in fourth out of the five boats in our category. Not a great finish, but the Rascals will be back on the water for the Wednesday night races, where they are currently in first place by a pretty wide margin. We make our way back to the slip to dock the boat and put away the sails. Every race ends with a $10 barbecue dinner at the Yacht Club, where the winners are announced and the trophy is presented. But tonight, the crew of the Rascal decided to hang out on the boat instead, have a couple rounds of dark and stormies, and watch the sunset in the water. For KCRW, I'm David Weinberg.
Oh, that sounds nice. Just ahead, issues of artistic direction and race in LA's theater community after one company canceled a play. You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. It was a play that was supposed to start earlier this month, an African-American performance called Passover at the Echo Theater Company in Echo Park.
Yo, Kitch, what you fix to do today, man?
I don't know. What you fix to do?
I got plans, you feel me? Big old plans. Man, I got plans to get up off this block, rise up to my full potential, be all I could be, you feel me?
Now, instead, the company fired the director of the play and then pulled the plug on it altogether. Now, what precipitated the firing and the nixing has a lot of folks in the LA theater community talking about this specific incident and what was at play in those decisions. Anthony Burns hosts Opening the Curtain on LA Theater on KCRW, and he's here to talk about it. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Steve.
All right, first off, what was this play about?
Well, this play called Passover originally had its world premiere at Steppenwolf Theater in Chicago. You just played a clip from the Spike Lee actually filmed that production. And a lot of people talked about it as kind of a Waiting for Godot infused African-American drama, right? It's these two black guys on a street corner, and it's kind of an exodus story, right? They're dreaming of getting off. They're dreaming of what might happen if they passed over to the promised land. And it has a lot of resonances with sort of Waiting for Godot. They're talking about their boots, their shoes, things like this, mm-hmm. and right? But it's larger than that, right? It's a very modern play. It's a very ancient play. It makes reference to the plantation south. It makes reference to the exodus out of Egypt. So it's trying to do a lot of stuff. And it's trying to speak very, very directly to police violence against black men. Not only is the play a tragedy, it's a tragedy that it didn't get to happen here in Los Angeles, or at least not yet.
Well, let's talk about that, because we know what the play is about. So what happened here, according to both parties?
There wasn't any controversy about doing it, the play. You know, the Echo Theater Company is actually one of my favorite companies here in L.A., and they've done a couple of really exciting productions lately that have been really daring in one way or another. But I think the big, big context you've got to put this in, right, is theater is a privileged white space, right? A couple years ago, grad student and I took a look at roughly 300 plays that had been done at the Mark Taper Forum, one of L.A.'s theater companies, big regional theater company in America, thought of as being one of the more diverse companies of the big regionals, right? And of those, we looked at the 300 plays that had been done in the last 50 years, and of those, 72% were written by white males, right? And when you look at the directors, you get even higher than that. You get to 78%. So it's across that backdrop that we have to see this specific thing. Now, what specifically happened here? There's a piece of this that's like the breakup of any relationship. Each side has their stories. Each side has their problems here. The important thing is this is like a breakup on the way to the altar. This is not like friends of yours who are together who broke up months before after they got engaged. This is like we are at the church, we're about to walk, and suddenly there's a breakup.
The play
right?
was about to start.
Right. It was the beginning of Tech, which is a week out. And what they say, the public line is artistic differences. They say that, you know, the theater company, Chris Fields, the artistic director, says he was really concerned about the work and didn't feel like it was in good shape and didn't want to put up anything that wasn't the highest quality product. Dina Selinow, who was the director, says that she felt like she was on the same page. She needed to see the piece in Tech, and her notes were very similar to Chris's notes, and they were going to get there, right? The big piece that's extraordinary here is theater companies of this size only do 5-6 productions a year. So to cancel one of them is a big deal. And as a theater company, if things were this far off, you should have known earlier. You should have figured that piece out. Now, the bigger question here is, okay, if we have the big backdrop of race and we say that there are some structural issues across all of American theater, how did that play out in this specific production? And I think this is where it might be really informative for the theater community and for all of us going forward, right? Because here's a traditionally white space that in one way or another is diversifying. And I think oftentimes that first diversifying sort of impulse is to say, okay, great, I'd love to hear your different story, but could you please tell your story in the way I tell my story,
right?
And even though that can
anglify it.
Exactly, right? Yeah. Like, tell me this story from a white lens, right? Because that's my audience, that's my board, that's whatever. And there's a sort of short-sightedness to that that requires a little bit of nuance. So the real tragedy here is, okay, great, you had a play that didn't go the way you wanted. Boy, you should have postponed it a couple of weeks and opened it later. Or at the point that you got to this, you should have understood what a big deal this was going to be to have a white man canceling an African-American play and then have the African-American director and then the design staff quit. Boy, that's short-sighted if you didn't see that one coming.
Is there an accusation of racism here? Because I know the director, Dina Selinow, took to Facebook writing that she is a black woman with a black cast that was replaced by a white director. Because that was the initial thing that happened, right? He fired the director, then replaced her.
Fired the director, replaced her. Then the next day, her design staff quit en masse in sort of solidarity. And then I believe the following day, the actors quit. And, you know, I talked to Dina yesterday, and this is so tricky because we want to go to sort of tiki torch racism at this moment, right? We want to go big picture and we want to say this is purely racial. No, she's not saying that, right? Is she saying, hey, wait a minute, there can be some bias here and maybe there was a lack of understanding and maybe this played out in ways that this person didn't trust me? Yeah, she is saying that. And it's a question about the whole ecosystem, because this isn't just a question of, hey, how do we get better artistic directors? We need to get more diverse boards. We need to get better funders. We need to get a more diverse audience. And everyone has this kind of fallback place of saying, you know, so I talked to Chris Fields about this. He says, well, it's all about the work, right? And there's a part of that you really respect, because if you're making art, it is about the work. But there's a lot of privilege that can get trapped up in that.
But if you're Chris Fields, you have to ask the question then, if it were a white director and this play were more geared toward a white audience, would he have done the same thing?
Right. And of course, when white is the norm, you don't even have to ask that question, right? That question doesn't even occur to you, because you're able to say, well, it's just about the work. I do this everywhere.
Yeah.
And you don't consider that you got to take care of more than just the work. You got to take care of the people, the audience, et cetera.
Thanks. And you would think L.A. being sort of, you know, I mean, L.A. is at the forefront of a lot of things. Maybe not in theater. I mean, it's always sort of lagged
behind
that
personally,
but
yeah,
other right. side of the country. But I'm just saying, you know, but L.A. you would think is a little grittier, right? That it would maybe allow for, you know, some creative license.
Yeah, we would hope, right? But again, let's look ourselves squarely in the mirror. Los Angeles theater doesn't look like Los Angeles, right? Los Angeles theater looks very white, right? And so the promise of LA is the promise of Los Angeles, is the promise of LA theater is, boy, could we really embrace this, and could we lead in that way? And there are great examples. There's East-West Players. You know, I want to put a plug in for a play across town called Scraps by Geraldine Anoa that's dealing, you know, one of the tragedies here is this play was going to speak to this other play, Scraps, that's also about police violence, and it's a wonderful African-American story, and it was going to be exciting to have those two plays on stage at the same time. So if you're dying to see this, you can see the Spike Lee film, which is pretty good, and if you want to see live theater, go see Scraps over at the Matrix Theater.
And do you think it'll get better?
I hope so. I think the very fact that we're talking about this today is an indication that, yeah, it will improve, right? It will get better. This is going to be difficult, and it's going to take little moments like this, hopefully, to raise awareness. You know, in a great way, a bunch of African-American theater artists in Los Angeles have sort of rallied around this and said, hey, we need to get together and talk. And I think that's one of the ways that it gets better. And then hopefully this will be a deep moment of reflection for this company to say, hey, wait a minute. How did this happen? How did we let this play out? And there'll be an initial moment of defensiveness where, you know, it will be about, well, it was just the work and we were right. And then hopefully there'll be a little bit more reflection, and they'll really, really try and find some real changes. And hopefully that'll make all the work better.
Anthony Burns, host of KCRW, is opening the curtain. Anthony, as always, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, coming up, your food deliverer wants a tip. The apps they work for may or may not give it to them. And that is creating a few problems in the gig economy. We're going to talk about it. It's KCRW's Greater LA. This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. I'm midway through the workday, which basically means I'm already exhausted. And now I have to think about what I'm going to make for dinner. I mean, isn't that what food delivery apps are for? Postmates, Uber Eats, DoorDash, Grubhub, Seamless. You know what I'm talking about. They are quick and they're easy, painless, guilt-free. Or are they guilt-free? Because recently a good number of those apps have come under fire for their business practices. Couriers struggling with low wages, vanishing tips, and some strict time constraints. And in the case of a couple of DoorDash couriers, some serious anger issues, too. Mona Holmes reports for Eater LA. She's a regular right here on Greater LA. Hi, Mona.
Hi, Steve.
Welcome back to you.
Thank you.
I'm still hungry, by the way. I feel like we've known that these delivery apps weren't treating their couriers that well for a while, right? I mean, that's been out there in the ether. Why is the spotlight still focused on them?
Well, there's a new spotlight on companies like DoorDash because of a New York Times article that just came out last week, where a journalist named Andy Newman decided to jump on his bike for a few days and temporarily become a delivery person.
A
courier for a day. Good for him. And there's actually really great footage of him navigating through the streets of New York. But it's a great piece to read because you get to witness how to experience what it's like for a driver to deliver food firsthand.
So, okay, Andy goes on the trip. He's on his bike. He's recording this. And in addition to the punishment that he's getting from the taxi cabs in New York and, you know, every, you know, people opening their doors while he's on it, things like that, he's also being sort of, I don't want to say abused, but these companies for which he works are not treating him the best.
Correct. Well, the big bonus about being a delivery driver is that they say that you can make really great money, and also as the bonus are tips. But it turns out that if you get something delivered to your home or work or wherever you are, and someone leaves you a $10 tip, they adjust the base pay according to that tip. And so it winds up being that you don't necessarily, as a driver, receive that money. And it's disappointing. And actually, the New York Times writer included that and noted that his pay changed according to the amount that he was left.
That sounds illegal.
It sounds shady, yeah. But it was good enough for the because the backlash against DoorDash came so hard and so fierce that only yesterday, the CEO of DoorDash, Tony Hsu, tweeted that due to recent feedback, the company will change its model so that the drivers will receive a bigger lion's share of customer tips on every order.
There are some examples of drivers who really want to get this food to their customers, and I guess they want to get the tip, they want to be speedy, but then they're working with, you know, they're dealing with restaurants who may not have that order ready. What kind of examples are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking about an incident in March with a DoorDash driver, and there's a restaurant called Good Pizza in Playa del Rey, and there was a DoorDash driver that came in, demanded to know whether his order was ready, and when it wasn't, he grabbed a tip jar, threw it across the room. The manager approached him and tried to push him out of the restaurant, and he actually hit her on the side of the head before fleeing without the food.
This reminds me, by the way, this whole episode of Domino. You remember Domino's Pizza, right?
Of course.
I mean, they're still around, of course. But they ensured their pizza delivery in 30 minutes back in the 1980s. You either get it in 30 minutes, you get it for free, right? And this had a lot of drivers maybe acting a little irresponsibly and trying to get that pizza to your home within the half hour.
Mm-hmm.
One of the drivers struck a woman in St. Louis. Domino's was forced to pay this woman out $78 million in damages. It's clearly different than the Domino's employee, but there have been some deaths and injuries as reported by the New York Times in this same kind of reporting that Andy Newman did. Is there something, Mona, to learn from that, looking at what we're dealing with today? I mean, is there, and I dare say, like a domino effect, no pun intended. Yeah.
Well, there's a ton of things that people can do. In fact, there's a question to how local governments and even federal governments can regulate this industry, which is largely flying on its own. There is even a group in Westwood that are a bunch of Chamber of Commerce folks and some restaurant owners that actually want drivers to be empowered in how they do things. And so, you know, because in restaurants, everyone who works in a kitchen is forced to have a food service handler's card. And all of these delivery drivers don't have that. You know, there are certain things that they need to understand about keeping foods at a certain temperature, making sure that their cars are clean. And I actually believe that that would come do a service to both the drivers and the customers receiving the food. And it would be a huge improvement from where we are now.
I mean, that sounds like common sense safety. I'm talking about safety as in, hey, you know, this person is rushing to get something to a customer, or this person is, you know, like maybe they think their tip will be bigger or something like that. I don't want to get run over if I'm like just barely on the sidewalk.
Oh, you're so right. And that could open up an entire can of worms of discussion with it. But it truly is a safety issue when it comes to you getting your food quickly. And I am sure that these companies want to address that, but they haven't really made any steps to do just exactly that.
Is there one app, do you think, that's better than the rest?
Well,
I'm going to put you on the spot. Hey, why don't you tell me, who's doing this better than the rest of them?
Well, I have not looked into it myself, but I have looked at other writers who have addressed this. And there's a piece in USA Today that broke it down. And they suggest that Grubhub is the best one. But even so, this in the same piece, they talked about how someone would need to work 40 hours a week in a full-time job, and that alone would only get them somewhere between $22,000 and about $25,000 a year.
Right.
And that's a lot of work and a lot of time in a very expensive city like Los Angeles.
Mona Holmes, reporter for Eater LA, contributor, of course, here at KCRW. Her recent article in Eater LA is titled DoorDash Drivers Caught Behaving Badly. You're always on your best behavior, though, Mona.
Thank always.
You. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, we have a lot of things to chew on these days. We'd love to hear from you on our Twitter or Facebook pages. Hashtag it, Greater LA. That's it for us today. Next week, day laborers are still trying to make ends meet, but now more than ever, they're trying to avoid ICE. Michael Silverblatt reads you a story next on KCRW. It's The Bookworm. You can hear us anytime at kcrw.com/greaterLA, the podcast, wherever you get them. Catherine Barnes, Jenna Cagle, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Reg Warner, Joel Stein, and Christian Bordahl all make this show happen. I'm Steve Chitakis. Thanks for your ear. Have a great day.